charismatic doctors can command the room and instantly earn trust. This isn't an innate ability. It's a learnable skill. So let's turn up your charisma so patients trust you before you even finish your first sentence. Dr. Nick Morgan is one of America's top communication theorists and coaches. As the founder of Public Words, he's spent decades helping leaders, entrepreneurs, TED speakers find their voices and master the hidden language of charisma. He's the author of several acclaimed books, including Power Cues, The Subtle Science of Leading Groups, Persuading Others, and Maximizing Your Personal Impact, which explores how the unconscious brain processes body language and social signals. He served as a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School and is a trusted coach to Fortune 50 CEOs, high-ranking government officials, and world-renowned keynote speakers. By bridging the gap between biology and public speaking, he teaches us how to physically and mentally prime ourselves to command any room and project authentic warmth, critical for your doctor-patient communication. But first, a word from our sponsors. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Nick Morgan, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
It's a great pleasure, Bradley, and great to meet you and to get a chance to chat.
Let's get started. So I want to start with when we first walk in the exam, right? You first walk in the exam room or the hospital room, and what we're doing is we're looking to balance authority, professionalism, empathy, and let's just work from like a harder situation where the patient's never met us before, right? This is the first time encountering this patient. What should we be paying attention to in terms of our nonverbal cues?
All right. So let's start by saying there are two ways to think about this. And this is an old actor's idea. The actor says, in order to get to the part that you need to play, you can either work from the outside in or you can work from the inside out. And what that means is you can either work from the behaviors, you can become mindful of your behaviors and allow that to drive the inside, that is the persona that's coming across, or you can work from the inside out. You can set your intention. You can manage your emotions so that you walk into the room with the right emotions that then drive the behaviors that you want to evince. Generally, I recommend to people you do a little bit of both, because for most people, working from the inside out, that is managing your emotions, is more challenging. And one can imagine a busy doctor going from room to room, from patient to patient. It's hard to reset and start with a fresh set of emotions and have them to be instantly appropriate for somebody you've never met before. That sounds challenging. So I suggest a mix of both. So that's the place to start from. In terms of that impressive list of adjectives you described, or the things that we want to convey to a patient, I heard empathy, trust, and of course, authority as the sort of top several. We could talk further about which are the most important. If we begin with authority, it's surprising really what conveys authority. One of the little things, for example, that conveys authority is the difference between somebody who is standing at their full height, taking up every millimeter that the universe gave them, their natural physique gave them, and somebody who's a little bowed, as I am bowing now, a little bowed by fatigue or the weight of all the things that they have to do that day or the seriousness of the last diagnosis. Whatever's on your mind can cause you to go into a more sort of withdrawn, self-referential physique. It can just be, as I say, sort of bowed down by the weight of all you're carrying. As soon as you do that, you give up authority. And so the first thing I would say, and your physicians already have a lot in mind, so I realize I'm adding one more thing, but the first thing I would say is, if you're really serious about conveying an authoritative impression to a patient without being arrogant, the single most important thing to do is to go stand next to a wall outside before you walk in and align yourself with that wall. And I'll do this here. I'll demonstrate it here. I put my feet against the wall, my legs against the wall, the extent I can, my butt against the wall, head against the wall, and I'm running out of cord here. But then as I walk forward, now I'm fully upright. And this conveys the authority that I have. Now, there are a number of other things that follow after that, but that's the single most important thing. Because as soon as I give up a little bit of my height, then I'm not occupying the full space the universe intended for me to have, and I'm giving up authority. So the first thing you can do is work on your posture. Posture conveys authority more powerfully than anything else.
So I'd say something simpler for physicians. To your point, what you said earlier about, you know, we've got a lot on our minds, right? We've got to figure out what's going on with the patient. We need to think about their social cues. We need to document all of this. We need to come up with a plan. So I think a simpler thing is just pay attention to your posture, right? Like, just be mindful of this. When you walk in the room, you want to exude authority and still make sure you're not slumped over. Like, just take a deep breath, stand up straight. And when you walk in the room, because, you know, that's easy because you haven't done anything yet with this patient, right? Like, you may have looked in their chart and you've got some things on your mind, but like, it's fairly straightforward and fast to take a deep breath, stand up straight, so that when you're greeting them, even for people that are smaller, when you're hunched over, what you're conveying is that you're tired or you're beaten down, as happened to many of us during residency. And so, you know, puffing that chest out and standing up straight, I think, is a great, simple thing that we can do every time. Yeah, I love that.
Yes. And I would add to that, at the risk of adding to the list.
Oh, no, that's what we're doing today. Today, we're adding to the listeners can do is they can say, you know what? That's something simple. You're not going to be able to do everything, but take the things that you think you can easily incorporate and just make them part of your routine.
So another aspect of authority, and also presence, because in addition to being authoritative, you want to be present for the patient, is focus. Doctors, like everybody else, walk around with a to-do list in their heads, things that happened before this particular patient meeting, there are things that are going to be happening after. They're naturally thinking about all those things. All of that to-do list shows up in your body language, in the fidgetiness of your body language at the simplest level. It can cause you, for example, to forget to make eye contact because your eyes go off to think about something you just remembered. Oh, I've got to do that at 10 o'clock. If I don't, there'll be trouble. Your eyes go off the patient. At that moment, the patient doesn't feel connected to you. And so a thing I recommend highly to executives, leaders of all kinds, but I think this is particularly important for doctors, is if you can possibly work it into your schedule, take a minute before you go into the room and do your best just to clear the to-do list. Whatever else is going on, say to yourself, I'm going to focus now on this patient. And one of the interesting things about the brain that we're learning, the neuroscience is showing, for example, if you want to remember something, if you tell yourself, brain, remember this, that does increase the likelihood that you'll remember it. The brain takes weirdly simple instructions sometimes. So this is a good one to work on, is to say, I'm going to focus on this patient, clearing my mind of the to-do list, in I go. And that I found can be effective. I've had a number of leaders reflect back to me that they found that useful before going into an important meeting, or in this case, patient.
And I've heard about that from when you talk about people who are super charismatic, like the Bill Clintons, the Barack Obamas, these people that just walk into a room and own the room. I've heard that when you speak to these people, that you feel like you're the only one in the room, right? When they're engaged with you, they are super engaged with you. And what you're describing is how to have some semblance of that superpower is you close all your mental browser windows. And we've talked about this on the show because you just saw 10 other patients and you've documented, but maybe you haven't finished their charts. Well, do what you can to finish those charts for a bunch of other reasons that we've talked about on other episodes. But another one is they're not taking up space. Your mental browser windows are now closed so that you have more attention, because what you're saying is you can't fake giving someone your undivided attention. You can't fake that, but you need to do it. And also, it's a time investment, because if you're investing those few seconds that you said to make sure that you're doing it, it's going to pay off because those visits are going to be shorter. Because the patient then knows that you've been listening intently the entire time.
That's right. It's going to increase the efficiency and therefore allow you to make quicker the patient. So I do recommend that. The other thing I would suggest, so this is the third thing we're adding to the list, but again, as you said, you can pick and choose, is to try to do something that I recommend in terms of listening in general, which is don't think of listening as just something you do with your mind or your ears or even your eyes, but think of listening with your whole body. And by that, I mean silencing quite deliberately all the physical chatter, making sure that you're turning your entire torso toward the patient, and just hold still. Because again, part of the to-do list that we have in our heads is as soon as we think we've got what we need from the patient, as soon as we think we understand the diagnosis, then already in our minds, we're starting to move on to the next patient because our schedule is so busy. And so that may cause us unintentionally to begin to turn towards the door, or for the body language chatter to begin to pick up a little bit, the eyes move or the torso moves. And so instead, while you're communicating with that patient, to the extent you can, you might have to do some physical things connected with checking the patient out. But to the extent you're actually listening, just listen with your entire body. Think of your body as a full-on listening vehicle. It's not just your eyes and ears.
Okay, so we've established how critical it is that the patient has our undivided attention. And you can't fake it. You have to actually give the patient your undivided attention. But we often walk in with distractions, right? We walk in, maybe the last patient encounter was a particularly challenging one. Maybe we got some bad news over the phone. You know, there are so many things that could be going on in our professional and personal life that could distract from that undivided attention that the patients deserve. So is there anything that we can do to really prime ourselves before we walk into the hospital room, before we walk into the exam room, to make sure that we can give them that attention?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. And aside from always having a serene, well-ordered and up-to-the-minute life and no complications, which I wish for all your listeners, of course. So the thing that really gets in the way is that we walk into a room, and this is all business people, not just doctors, but doctors walk into a room with a to-do list in their head. They're making rounds or they're halfway through the day, and they picked up a number of things that they have to do. That to-do list is very distracting and shows up in your body language. So you're twitching in various ways. You suddenly think of something that you're reminded of, and that causes you to roll your eyes back and you step toward the patient. You get impatient. You step back from the patient and so on. So the to-do list in your head is the single most important thing to work on before you walk into the room. And that is to make a deal with yourself, just to say, all right, I have a to-do list in my head. Temporarily, I'm putting it aside. I'm clearing my mind and I'm going to walk into that room with one focus and one focus only. And that's the patient. And that takes practice, but it's surprising how quickly you can master that technique if you work at it. And various ways may help. If you already know the patient, you might get a picture of that patient in your head. Or if you have some paperwork and you can read the paperwork, there are various ways to help you focus. But the idea is to be there already before you go into the room. And that means clearing the to-do list from your head.
Is there a ritual that you have that reminds you to do it? Or is there something specific that you do when you're going into a meeting and need to do that?
Oh, well, I'm smiling because you remind me when I started in the speaking business, it was because I started writing speeches for the governor of Virginia. I came to rescue the previous speechwriter who had had a nervous breakdown, and it was over work. I should have asked more questions before I took on the job. So there I was, and at first, they allowed me to go along with the governor to get to know him so that I could speak with his voice more quickly. And I noticed as he stood off stage in various settings, waiting to go on stage, that as he was being introduced, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the governor of Virginia, applause, he would make this funny little twitch of his head. And this seemed to be something he was consistently doing before he went on stage. And finally, I worked up the courage to ask him, "Governor, what is it you're doing when you do that little twitch?" And he laughed and he said, he'd been a Marine, and he said, "They train us in Marine school to develop a specific gesture that allows us to fully focus when we're going into a leadership situation. And that practice, it's a mental practice of erasing the to-do list and deciding for the next few minutes, I'm going to focus entirely on what's happening in front of me. Then if you add a physical gesture to that, that helps remind you. And finally, over time, it helps condition that and prepare you to do that. So maybe a twitch of the head. Maybe there's something else that your doctors would like to learn that will accomplish that. But
it's funny, that reminds me of Superman. So in the original Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, when he would switch from Clark Kent to Superman, he took off his glasses. And the way you see his posture change and his facial expression change when he switches from, and the new Superman, David Corenswet, took cues from that and did that himself. So the taking off of the glasses was his cue to switch from this persona to that persona. And it seems like we need just a little something that reminds us, okay, I'm going into undivided attention mode.
Yes, I love that. The glasses becomes the cue, because yeah. Superman, of course, didn't wear glasses. So he's taking on the new role. It is a role, and that's a good reminder. And to prepare for a role, actors talk themselves into the emotional state that's required for that role. And in this case, it's clarity, isn't it? So learning how to talk yourself into or to still your mind to be clear and present is just like Superman taking off his glasses. So if you can talk with a great gesture like that, I think it'll be something you can really reinforce and then do more and more easily as time goes on.
It also makes me think of the placebo effect, because with the placebo effect, you have to do something. You can take sugar pills, and it might work, but you can't pretend to take them. It has to be an act, and it doesn't matter what you do, but do something, and that'll be your switch.
That's right. And the reason for that is, as I'm sure all your doctors know, the way our minds work is we make unconscious decisions. We undertake unconscious actions. Most of our brain activity is unconscious in various ways, and we start acting. So if we decide we're going to leave the room unconsciously, we're not consciously aware of it yet, we will start moving toward the door as an act based on that unconscious decision. We become consciously aware of it milliseconds after we begin the gesture. It's actually the gesture that cues the conscious thought for us. And that's counterintuitive for people who haven't heard that, but that suggests that embodiment is a very useful way to cue any kind of conscious thought with a little training.
And so what we're doing is we're really priming ourselves to give these body language cues that we are giving our undivided attention. If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the other shows over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Doctors Making a Difference. Be inspired by Dr. Peter Crane of Doctors Making a Difference. Discover stories of physicians who are transforming lives and communities. Celebrate the impact of medicine beyond the clinic. Listen and subscribe to be part of the movement. So I want to switch gears a little bit and ask about reading those cues, because that's really something that we've talked about on other episodes where once you get into practice for a while, you end up seeing the same diagnoses over and over, right? You see the same problems. A lot of times you can walk in the room and you know exactly what the patient has. Now, certainly we need to hear their story and make sure we're correct and double check and right. But often it's not as big a cognitive load once you've been doing this for a while as there once was. And that frees up some mental space to read the room. And so what I'd like to know from you is, how do we do that? How do we do that? Because I think I can do that. I'm trying to do that. But maybe there are some cultural barriers in the way. Like, what are some simple things that I can do to try and read the nonverbal cues of those that I'm speaking to?
All right. So first of all, we have to state a few basic non-intuitive rules understandings, because there's a lot of myth out there about what reading body language is and what it isn't. And one of them is that we can become instantly expert if we're sufficiently clever or practiced in reading body language, that we can read the body language of somebody that we don't know instantly and accurately. And I've seen that on various television shows. so-called body language experts who are detectives who immediately suss out the crime, who the guilty party is by reading body language. We're actually very good, we humans, at reading body language of people that we know well, our loved ones, colleagues that we've known for a long time, people that we've observed and studied for a long time.
We know exactly their patterns, and when the patterns change, we know there's something going on. Yeah,
exactly.
That makes sense.
So the classic instance of that is you've been married to your spouse for a nice long time, and he or she comes home at the end of the day, and instantly you say, what happened? Because you just see it all over them that something has happened. You see the emotional, there's excitement or anger or some strong emotion, and you know what their baseline of behavior. And so you can see the variation. And that's really what reading body language is noting the variations. All right. So first, we need to understand that if we're talking about somebody that we don't know, we haven't met before, we need to be very careful in jumping to conclusions, because body language is always multi-determined. And by that, I mean, if I fold my arms, it may be because I'm defensive, as the body language people always tell you, or it may be because I'm cold. Or maybe because I'm tired and this is comfortable as a way of resting, or there could be 100 reasons. And so we can't jump to conclusions immediately. All right. So with those caveats, then there are some basic aspects of body language that if you train yourself to notice them, you can learn a lot. And so one of them, for example, very simple, is we humans move towards things that we like and we move away from things that we don't like. And that's deeply instinctive. You get a bad smell and you get the reaction of somebody sniffing in and rearing up and moving backward. It's instinctive, right? And that's universal. It's rare, unless you have somebody who's like a mushroom expert and smells something that smells like a mushroom and suddenly goes in and determine what it is, right? So there can be exceptions. But on the whole, we move toward things that we like and away from things that we don't like. And so on the whole, also, we tend to protect ourselves by bringing our hands in front of our torso when we feel less safe. And we tend to open up when we feel more safe. And so the classic instance of this is when you see a loved one, you open up your arms and hug them. You're bringing them into your heart space because you feel safe with them. That feels like a safe thing to do. Whereas typically when we meet somebody new, we find some way or other to keep our hands in front of our torso unless we're instantly comfortable with them or attracted to them. So you can look for proximity, people moving towards you and away from you, and you can look for closed and open behavior. And the prime place to look is in the face, because we humans react first and most strongly in the face. We are primed to look to the face for emotional reactions. Most of us react in pretty simple ways when it comes to facial expression. For example, if we see something we like, we tend to open our eyes wide and autonomically our pupils open wide. And that's one that's very hard to fake or alter or control. I'm not aware of anybody who can do that. Maybe there's some that I'm not aware of yet. And I hope I never play poker with them. But so you open your eyes wide and you narrow your eyes to show the opposite when you feel suspicious or you're questioning or self-protective and so on. So we look for openness in terms of the face and in terms of the body. That tells us how receptive that person is to what we're saying or what we're doing or so on.
Because if I'm explaining something to a patient and they've got this open face, open posture, that tells me, okay, I can continue as I am. Whereas yes, if they withdraw a little bit, they close up their face a little bit, they close up the posture a little bit, that tells me, take a step back. You might have to ask a question. Make sure they're understanding, make sure they're okay with everything, right? Like this is kind of like bobbing and weaving, but it's all, as you're describing it, pretty simple. Open face, open posture, closed face, closed posture.
Right. And it's rare that you'll have somebody who deliberately or consciously does the opposite. These behaviors happen, as I say, unconsciously, and they usually help the person themselves determine how they're feeling, in fact, rather than the other way around. So we don't think to ourselves, oh, I should be open. And so we then bring our hands wide open and move toward doctor and try to hug him. You know, that's just not a human behavior. Humans react emotionally first and they react unconsciously emotionally first. So it's a good way to at least get the basic idea of how the patient is feeling.
That's fantastic. So Are there any other cues? So I just want to make sure that we've covered all of the basics here. So open face, open posture, closed face, closed posture. Any other tips there that we might be looking for in our patients to make sure they're either one, understanding versus not understanding, or feeling threatened in some way where we need to maybe joke around with them, maybe ask them about their personal, maybe something like to disarm them, to feel like we need to get them to know, like some icebreakers to get them a little less on the defensive.
Well, yeah, one of the amusing ones, very much depending on the situation, is that we humans, in addition to deciding instantly whether the person that we just met is friend or foe, which causes us to either open up or shut down in various ways. That's the first question our unconscious minds ask. And so you think about a patient, they might decide that the doctor is a friend because the doctor is going to help them in some way, help them cure a problem that they have. Or they might decide the doctor is a foe because they're afraid of what the doctor might tell them. And so if you see a foe response, in other words, somebody closing down, the face closing down, the behavior turning negative, maybe even turning away, we tend to turn away from things that we don't like as opposed to turning toward them. The second thing that we do is we sort out the hierarchy in the room. Now, one imagines in the case of patient, it's almost always the case, I would think, that the doctor would be the authority and the patient would be lower in status in that situation. So a very interesting thing to look for would be if the patient stands up straight or tries to meet the doctor or tries to tower over the doctor. So that depends. If your doctor is 6'5" and the patient is 5'5", you know, that's been sorted out already just in terms of their physical height. But if they're equal in height or if the doctor happens to be shorter, then there's an opportunity for a little role playing going on there. If the patient decides he or she doesn't like the advice, one thing they might want to do is try to stand up and kind of tower over the doctor to say,
yeah,
I'm the patient and I have authority here. So looking for the hierarchical structure in the room, you won't always get information on that, but that is the second big question that people ask when they meet somebody. And so unconsciously, they're probably going to do something like that. Now, what I would recommend for the doctor to do in that situation, and this is what I recommend for speakers and executives to do when they have a hostile questioner or cantankerous person in the audience who's asking difficult questions, is rather than follow your instinct, when we meet somebody who's angry at us or fighting with us or arguing with us, our instinct is to back up. We don't like that on the whole, right? Instead, you want to close in because it's much harder to maintain that hostility in closer quarters. And so what I recommend people to do is adopt the same posture and same direction as, in this case, the patient. So if I had to deliver very bad news to a patient, one instinct would be to sit down and look the patient in the eye very carefully, making eye contact and say in a quiet voice, I'm really sorry about these, however you might do it, deliver the bad news. Another way, and a bit counterintuitive, would be to sit next to them and align yourself so you're facing the same direction. This is something I also advise parents to do when they have teenagers. The best way to talk to your teenager, every parent knows, is to get them in a car and drive somewhere. Why? Because you're both sitting in car seats facing in the same direction. So your body language is aligned in that sense.
It's and like you're same in a, team.
You're right? Same team. Exactly. Yeah. You're in agreement. And so if you've got a difficult patient or a cantankerous patient or one to whom you have to deliver bad news, then I would consider, rather than standing across from them, which is, after all, inherently a confrontational position. It can be friendly and you can defuse it and whatnot, but it's inherently confrontational. If I'm facing you and then delivering bad news, I would suggest sitting next to them and turning so that you're facing them and you can make eye contact with them, but your body is basically oriented in the same direction they are. Now, depending on the layout of the room, that may be easier or harder. And if they're lying in the bed, of course, you can't quite do that. But if the situation permits,
align as much as you can. Yeah.
Right. Mirroring is a very strong way to say to a person unconsciously, I'm on your side. We're in this together. Seems to me that's a message a patient would like to hear, especially in difficult diagnoses under stress.
Also in situations of conflict. We just had a couple episodes actually on conflict resolution when the patient is hostile. Maybe you messed up their appointment. Maybe you didn't call them back with the results. Maybe they're really upset about something. setting up your posture, your positioning in a certain way to let them know, not just verbally, but non-verbally, that you're on their team is going to be very powerful. So that actually ties into some other recent episodes that we've done. That's fantastic.
And the other thing that's very important, and this you can use no matter what the situation, no matter what the logistics of the room are, but it's extremely important to understand, is we all monitor four zones of space. And this was work done a couple of decades ago by a guy named Benjamin Hall, and he tried to invent a new science called kinesthesics. And for obvious reasons, that didn't take off. It's kind of a hard word to say, but he meant the science of how people interact with each other in space. And he had good findings. It's just his branding didn't work well on this. But what he found was, using feet rather than meters, if you're into metrics, you can translate your head, but 12 feet or more is public space. And so if I'm standing 12 feet away from somebody, my unconscious mind hasn't even noticed them yet. 12 feet to 4 feet is social space. So that's warmer, but it's not intimate yet. That's cocktail party distance. That's a casual chat. Then 4 feet to a foot and a half in the West is personal space. And then a foot and a half to zero is intimate space. And so in effect, the only space that's really available and appropriate for a doctor is that space between a foot and a half and 4 feet. That is personal space. I would say not intimate space, because you're not an intimate with the patient. Unless I'd be very surprised, but intimacy is reserved for...
There are laws against that. Although when we're examining them, right.
If you have to deliver a difficult diagnosis, the temptation would be to stay more than 4 feet away, because it's easier to do that if you're not as personally connected. When you're between 4 feet and a foot and a half, personal, and you really feel that connection, that the two of you are connected. And so I would say anything important, when I teach body language to business execs, I say the only significant things that happen between people happen in personal and intimate space. Intimate space is off limits to you 99 times out of 100. So that means you need to do your real work in personal space, 4 feet to a foot and a half. And I would say the same is true for giving difficult diagnoses for doctors.
So our tendency is to step back a little bit if we're having a difficult conversation, but we should be leaning in. Where we should be working against what we might have a tendency to do. Is there anything else that you see in the body language area where physicians might be doing something unintentionally that they're unaware of, where they really need to change that behavior?
Yes, I would say the single most powerful thing you can do is, I'm sure all doctors are trained to listen when their patients are speaking, but they're very busy people and have lots to do, and sometimes patients, because they have a lot to say, you need to school yourself when you're listening to somebody to do what I call listening with your whole body. Now, what that means is, if you're the patient and I'm facing you and you're telling me a set of symptoms, or I'm giving you a diagnosis and you're responding to it, then I need to not only make the eye contact, which everybody has been trained to do, I'm sure, but also I need to still my entire body. I need to make sure my body is oriented towards you. I see this in doctor's offices all the time when I go in. And sometimes I say, I'm an expert on body language. Let me tell you what's wrong with your body language. That tends not to go over well. So I've taken not to do that. But what happens?
Wait till the end of the visit. Wait till after they've given you whatever news or done whatever procedure.
Right. But what I've seen lately is the doctor will sit at a desk and be entering data, because they're trying desperately to keep up with all the data they have to enter. Yep. And so that means the doctor is sitting facing the computer, and I'm sitting over here on the table in a chair at that point. And so the doctor turned away from me. And so whatever I say, I don't believe unconsciously that the doctor is listening to me. And this, I realize, is a very difficult thing to resolve, because you have enormous amounts of data you have to collect with every visit. But somehow you have to figure out a way, when important communications are happening, to listen with your whole body. So that means facing the patient, making the eye contact, but having your whole body turned toward them, having it be open, and having it be still. Don't fidget.
And if you can do that,
that's charismatic listening.
Is there a time period? Because, yes, I do need to take notes on what the patient is saying. I do need to take notes of my physical exam. I need to write up the plan. I need to order tests. So all that needs to happen. I got 3 patients in the waiting room. I got 5 patients I need to call back, right? So this is the reality of our situation. It needs to happen for 80% of the visit or just during critical exchanges of information. Like, is there some minimum? Like, I'm looking for a minimum effective dose for what doctors would use.
Yeah, I would say whenever critical information is being exchanged, and especially early on in the relationship, if you have a long, trusting relationship with a patient, then you can cut corners in this kind of thing. But it's a highly charged situation and it's bad news and the patient is telling you about aches and pains that are potentially life-threatening, then you need to be all focused looking at that patient. As I say, the body language open, still. The key is being still. We talk about this in the business as charismatic listening, and may seem like an odd term because we think of charisma as something somebody performs.
Something active.
Yeah. Then I go out and I get angry or I give a great speech. That's charisma, right? But you'd be astonished at how charismatic it is for somebody else to be listened to with that level of intensity. And so you don't need to do that for more than a couple of minutes. Now, we do get patients. We do get people who like to talk about themselves and keep going. And as you say, there are 3 other patients waiting. At that point, I would gently interrupt and let me make sure I understand what you're saying. And then I would paraphrase back what the key elements are. If you do that and you get a nod from the patient, then that's a successful listening experience.
At the bare minimum, during critical emotional parts when they're telling their story, you need to be doing that charismatic listening. When you're giving them critical bits of information, you need to be doing charismatic listening. The very beginning of the visit, when you're first walking in because you're setting the tone, also anything in addition to that is certainly preferred and ideal, but do it as best you can during those critical moments, at least.
If you can start the conversation with a beautiful kind of focus and attention and openness, you can get a long way and you can build trust that people decide whether they trust you or not. We used to say it took 30 seconds. And now it turns out that because of a study done on people's voices, we can decide how much we trust you. And it's pretty consistent across people. And it's pretty durable over time. We can decide how much we trust you if you say hello to us. Just in the 2 seconds it takes to say hello, we've already made that decision about you. And so we're not talking about huge investments of time here, but we are talking about huge investments of attention. And that's why it's so crucial to, as we said earlier, erase that to-do list in your head, stop your body language, and go in with clarity and focus.
Pretend to take off your Clark Kent glasses and then walk in that room. Amazing. Yeah. Dr. Nick Morgan, if people want to learn more about you, if they want to find your books, where can we find you online?
My website is publicwordswithad.com. And the good news is we're right in the middle of overhauling it. I have, over the years, published something like 2,000 blog posts. We're going to weed those out so you won't have to read them all to get all the juicy information. And we're going to organize it. But yeah, so there's a lot of free information on there about body language, about listening, about communications. And it's searchable with an index. I urge you to check that out. Find out all about us.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time and all the wisdom that you shared with us. This is going to translate to a lot of doctors helping more people in a more effective way. So thank you so much for your time.
Beautiful. Love to hear that.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice, or financial advice, or legal advice, or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.